Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So we do that chant to scare away the ghosts, so they can't come and listen to the talk. Only the heavenly beings such as you can listen to the talk today on a very profound subject, Buddhism and bananas. But before I begin, you were mentioning that my name is affectionately known as Ajahn Brahm. And I shortened it from Brahmawangsa because that was far too hard for Australians to remember. But it also gets me into trouble many times. Because once I gave a talk at a school in Australia, a girls' school. Now in Australia, girls when they reach about 13 or 14 get very cheeky. But I gave a nice talk to their class, and I just happened to be walking in Perth the following day, and some of the girls from that school were walking towards me. And they said, "Hi, how are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, you remember me? Yeah, you came to our school yesterday. Oh, is that so nice you remember me?" I said to them. And they said, "How can we ever forget you? How can we ever forget a monk called Ajahn Brahm?" I said, "There's an M on the end." So that's cheeky girls in Australia calling me Ajahn Brahm. So please remember there is an M on the end. So I really tried to pronounce that. But whenever you give a talk, sometimes I've been to Buddhist talks and they give some very deep teachings, but everybody falls asleep. And so it's a waste of time for everyone. And so because of that, I make sure when I give talks, to keep people alive, awake, and so they can actually hear the teachings. And one Tibetan monk told me some years ago that it's great to make people laugh when you're giving a Dhamma talk. Because only when their mouths are open can you put in the pill of Dhamma. So that means that you can actually teach people, because that's what you remember. So today I'm going to give a talk on Buddhism and bananas. Now, number one, that's excellent marketing. Because people, what the hell is he going to talk about? Never heard a talk like that before. Yes, you can talk about Four Noble Truths, heard that, Eightfold Path, done that, compassion, done that, dependent origination, yeah, we've been there, don't understand it, but I've listened to it before. But bananas. See, I can understand that. But, like many things, you don't realize how profound a banana can be. And by the end of this talk, I think you'll look at bananas in a totally different way. So, number one, I'm going to ask you, do you eat bananas? Do you like bananas? Very good. Now, when you peel a banana, how do you peel a banana? Which end do you start from? Now, most people are just through conditioning, through habit, through seeing what other people do. You peel the banana from the stalk. Now, that is a very stupid thing to do. It just shows that human beings, they do what they want to do rather than listening to the experts.
Now, who are the experts with bananas?
Monkeys, yes! Have you ever seen how a monkey peels a banana? Next time, you may go up to, you know, just south of Sandakan, see how the orangutans in the things actually eat bananas. If you go into the jungle, the monkeys, they peel a banana from the other end. The end where the flower used to be. You know why they do that? Because they are the experts. So as human beings, you should follow the experts. And then you find peeling a banana is much easier. Tomorrow, you try that. You get a banana for breakfast and you peel it at the other end and you'll discover an amazing secret. It's much easier to peel the banana from the opposite end. Now, why did you always peel bananas from the stalk? You're just following tradition, that's all. And that's one of the problems with people with Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, all these things. Too many traditions we're following without asking what we're doing it. Like for Buddhism, I told this, I think, this morning. Why is it in the temples here in Sabah and in all Chinese areas, why is it that when people go to the temple with incense stick, why do they always shake the incense sticks? Do you ever understand why? I will tell you why people actually shake the incense before they put it in the urn. The reason is this. Most people, most Buddhists, first go to the Buddhist temple when they're taken there by their grandmothers. Your grandmas take you there. Did I tell the story last night, or was it somewhere else? Yeah. Yeah, it was somewhere else, yes. They're taken there by their grandmas. And the grandmas, they take up the incense, they light it, and they do this. And their children follow them blindly. Grandma did it, therefore we must do it. But the reason Grandma shakes the incense is because she's got Parkinson's disease. And she has to shake it. And all the children, they go following just because Grandma did it. And they all think that that's what you're supposed to do. How stupid we are. You don't have to do that. Just put the incense in to the pot. Have you ever noticed, especially old Buddhist temples, how their wooden floors are very highly polished? Do you know where that came from? It's because all the people meditating on the floor, every time they fidget, their fat bottoms shine up the wood. And that's how it becomes, after hundreds of years, how it becomes very highly polished. So many bottoms have been fidgeting during meditation. But, just like with the incense, follow the experts. And who are the experts? They're your monks. And if you follow the experts, then you won't have so many problems and sufferings in life. You do it your own way, and you find you have lots of difficulties. So in life, ask the questions. Follow the experts and you'll just find, like when peeling a banana, if you peel it at the other end, there's not so much suffering. So this is why Buddhist monks and nuns teach. We are the experts on the mind and on meditation and how to be happy. I told you last night on the questions, the happiest person in the world. And this was objective, because you can put a person in a magnetic resonance scan and you can find out what parts of the brain light up, and there's a certain part of the human brain lights up when you're happy. And this Professor Davison, Wisconsin University in US, was investigating to try and find out who the happiest people in the world are. And when he got to the Buddhist monks, their happiness went off the scale. That part of the brain which lights up
was just incandescent. So look, we are the experts on happiness. If we say peel a banana from the flower end, try it. It works. So, you should start practicing the Dhamma. You know that a lot of times people actually, I'm sure this happens in Sabha as well. If you have any difficulties with your health or with your mental health, you have to go and see doctors and also psychologists. You know how much those psychologists charge? They charge a lot of money. You come to temple, we do it for the cheap, for free. That's why many people actually come and listen to my talks. I'm cheap. You know, once somebody rang up one of our monks, and the conversation went like this. Do you teach meditation? And the monk replied, yes, madam, I do. And the woman, an American, said, how much do you charge? And the monk said, we don't charge anything, it's for free. And the woman said, well, if it's for free, you can't be any good then. Because in many places, they think that if it's for free, it can't have any value. So these days, we never say it's for free. These days, when they ask me, how much do you charge for your talks? I say, it's not for free, it's priceless. Which is a much better way of saying it. And because, you know, the Buddhist monks know about happiness, you should follow them when it's how to be happy. Now the next simile is a banana. What shape is a banana? It is bent, like a lovely crescent. So if you want to have happiness, you should develop a mouth in the shape of a banana. That's right. Turn up the edges. Now, when I was first in Thailand, this is about the banana mouth teaching. When I was first in Thailand, it was 37 years ago now. I've been a monk for 37 years. Now, in those days, whenever we'd go from one monastery to another, we'd go in the back of what you call a pickup truck. You know, they've got a cabin in the front and they've just got a tray in the back. This morning, we were just going out for lunch and there was one of these working men cars, you know, with a tray in the back parked outside the temple. And I asked, am I going in that truck? Because you see, many workers go in the back. In those days, that's where we'd have to sit. In the back of a truck. And they'd have little seats in the back for the monks to sit in. And on the back of the tray of the truck, they'd have a metal frame. Over the frame was stretched a canvas. So if it rained, you'd be protected from the rain. And if there was lots of dust, again, it would not come into the car because these were all dirt roads in those days. Now, we were protected from the rain and the dust, but what we weren't protected from was the potholes. Because those were dirt roads, there were monsoons, and when it rained, parts of the road would get eroded, and they'd have all these holes in the road. The trouble was, when the truck passed over a pothole, the truck went down, and I went up. And you hit your head on these metal frames. And my goodness, that hurt. It may be okay for you, not the venerable, but for each one of you, because you've got padding on your head. For monks, we've got bald heads, we've got no protection. And of course, you know, being taller than the Thai monks, I kept hitting my head so often. Now, because I was Westerner, and now you've seen this, when Westerners hurt their head, what do? They swear. So I swore in English, so the Thai monks couldn't understand what I was saying. But Even though they didn't understand the English, they knew I was upset. And I kept on banging my head and banging my head. But I noticed a strange thing. When those Thai monks banged their head, they never swore. They laughed. And I couldn't figure that out. Why is it that Thai monks laugh when they hit their head, while Western monks swear? And so I was a scientist before, physicist at Cambridge. So I decided to think, what could be the reason? My first hypothesis was that those Thai monks, they must have hit their head so many times they're brain damaged. How else can you laugh when you hit your head and it hurts? But then I realized I knew those monks, they weren't brain damaged. So I decided to do an experiment. I decided, next time I hit my head, I'm going to try laughing instead of swearing. And I did that. The next time I hit my head, I laughed like the Thai monks instead of swearing. And you know what I found out? It hurts much less. It does. If you don't believe me, ask the person sitting next to you to hit you on the head. Somebody did that. If you swear, it hurts. If you laugh, it hurts much less. Now, that you may think is a simple teaching, but actually that can be very profound. Because many things in life are things you don't like, maybe even unpleasant, even painful. If you laugh, life hurts much less. If you have to go to the doctor, if you are doing a presentation at work, if you are doing examinations at school, if you laugh and smile, you get higher grades. Money back guarantee. It is true, because what happens when you smile, when you laugh, you relax. Not only relaxing, but any doctor would say when you laugh, endorphins get secreted into your bloodstream, nature's painkillers, it increases your immune system. If you get happy laugh in difficult situations, you find it hurts less, you heal much quicker. So, even emotionally, if somebody criticizes you, if your husband scolds you, laugh. And it hurts much less that they think, you're a crazy wife. And they never scold you again. Number two, it's very, very good for your health, because somebody sent me a science paper. I always like collecting science papers because I'm ex-scientist. Because all these recent research, it actually confirms what someone like the Buddha taught 25 centuries ago. And this particular science paper was showing that when you laugh, your arteries and veins expand. When you get miserable or angry, your arteries and veins contract. And that answered an important question. Why is it that fat monks like me are always happy? Why is it that fat people are always jolly? And this is the reason why. Because if you're overweight and you're miserable, angry and depressed, your arteries contract and all that extra cholesterol, gut and other stuff going through your veins, it clogs it up. But if you're happy and laugh a lot, your veins expand, which means you can cope with extra cholesterol and fat in your arteries. It can all get through because you've got fat arteries. So any one of you who are overweight right now, you better start laughing quick. Otherwise, you could die soon. So, obviously that you come here and you get laughing practice, but I'm not going to be here all the time. So I'm going to teach you how to develop the banana mouth. Because this, my first meditation teacher told me this. And this helped enormously. It was a very, very simple teaching. He asked me, I was still a young student at Cambridge. He asked me, what do you do when you first get up in the morning? And I said, I go to the toilet. He said, very good. And he said, is there a mirror in the bathroom? I said, of course there is. He said, now, I want you to do this every morning from now on. I want you, before you even go to the toilet, to look at yourself in the mirror and smile at yourself. And I said, sir, I am a student. I stay up late at night. I won't tell you what I've been up to. I'm just a young man. And sometimes I feel so tired in the morning. I'd be afraid to look at myself. If I saw myself first thing in the morning, I'd probably scream. And he said, I don't care. He said, stand in front of the mirror and smile at yourself. And I say, impossible. He said, okay, if you can't manage a natural smile, he said, get out your two fingers. Have your two fingers out. Please, on your two fingers. Put them on the side of your mouth, he said.
And push up.
Make yourself smile. And I took his advice. For 2 years, hardly missing a morning, every morning when I got up, I went and looked in the mirror, and if I couldn't manage a natural smile, I'd get my two fingers and push the sides of my mouth up to make them look like a banana. And I saw this stupid young man making a face in the mirror. And I started laughing. I started every morning for 2 years laughing at myself. What a wonderful way to start the day. A quick boost of endorphins into your bloodstream keeps your body healthy, creates a beautiful sense of the day. That made me successful in my studies. It made me popular with my friends. Look, all of you young people who were looking for a girlfriend one day or a boyfriend, who likes to go out with a miserable girl? Who wants to go out with an angry boy? When they smile a lot, it makes you attractive. And it's much cheaper than going to salon. It's true, isn't it? Isn't happy, smiley people, aren't they attractive? Don't you like to come around and be with them? Of course you do. So this is how you can get boyfriend. Every morning in the mirror, do smiling training. And after about 2 years, it stuck. That's why I smile a lot now. I wasn't born like this. It's just training. And when you learn how to laugh a lot and smile a lot, it makes life much easier. Somebody came up to me and they have a lot of anxiety. A lot of anxiety when they go for interviews, especially because they've done their examinations, they've been through university, but when they go to interviews for jobs or they have to do presentations in their company for business, they always get very, very nervous. And they came up to me and said they had a big presentation to do and they were very nervous. Actually, she was a doctor. Now, she'd been a doctor for a couple of years and she had to present something to her peers to get the next stage up as a doctor in Australia. And she's a great doctor, but you have to present that to your peers. Well, these are no senior doctors. And she said she was so nervous. She was actually from Bangladesh, so her English was a second language. And that's what I told her. He said, when you go in, before you go into that room, two fingers, push your mouth up, start smiling. And you'll find the anxiety will mostly disappear. She came up afterwards and she said, it worked. I did a great presentation. I surprised myself. I wasn't nervous at all. And I said to her, I told you so. Because it works. So learning how to smile gives you confidence. Now, for those of you who are serious Buddhists who meditate, I've taught meditation for many, many years. And one of the things people ask me is your posture. How should you sit when you're meditating? Now, I've taught for many, many years, and I've seen people in all sorts of meditation postures. And basically, I don't care how you have your legs. You have them full lotus, half lotus, or no lotus. And you can have them dangling over a chair. It doesn't matter. You can still get deep meditation. You can have your back straight, your back all over the place. I don't care where you have your hands. Now, on your knees, like the Tibetans, or in your palm, in your lap, like the Theravadins, or even on your head. I don't care what you do with them. The only important part of your posture, which is important, which will affect your meditation, is your mouth. You put a smile on, and straight away the meditation gets easier. And also, you're adding the important ingredient of piti sukha, which is a very important part of meditation. The happiness. And I've seen this because I've seen many people meditating. Because I'm the teacher, I'm sitting in front of people. And all these people in front are meditating. You know, a lot of time I'm afraid to open my eyes. What I see there. So many people look so ugly when they're trying too hard. And all they need to do, a little smile on their face, it changes the attitude to meditation. Meditation becomes fun. You know my meditation center in Perth. You know what it's called? It's called Club Med Perth. Club Med, Club Meditation. So I know, Santa Juana Forest Hermitage. You've got a little retreat center there. Maybe you can call it Club Med, Kota Kinabalu, Club Meditation. Now straight away, that's good marketing. People like to come there because they don't think it's painful. And it also, it makes people smile, realizing that meditation does actually increase your happiness. And that is actually a profound trick which I've used on many people to take them to deeper levels of meditation. I told him in the middle of the meditation, what are you doing with your mouth? Smile for goodness sake. It makes the meditation easier. You add piti sukha. It engages the mind. And your meditation gets very, very deep. Don't forget the smile. Look, when I was in Cambridge, I got roped in to doing rowing, you know, on these big eights, and you see all the people, Oxford versus Cambridge. I never got up to that standard because I was never competitive. As a monk, I can't understand why people are competing so much. I like to play soccer mostly, and the last game of soccer I ever played, there was only 9 of the other team turned up. There was 11 of us. And after about half time, those of you who know soccer, we were about 6-7 nil up. It was just a one-sided game. So at half-time, I went over to my captain and said, is it all right if I play for the other side in the second half? Just to make a game of it, 10 against 10. Oh, and that captain swore at me, you can't play for the other team. And that was the last game of soccer I ever played. Because I wasn't really concerned about winning. I was concerned about enjoying myself. And in fact, over in Perth, you know, just to be able to create more harmony between people, I often thought of starting a Buddhist soccer team. You know, a real Buddhist soccer team. You can play the Catholics, the Muslims, the Hindus. But then I thought there'd be a problem. Because if it was a Buddhist soccer team, you know, like the Aloka team, for example, you know, just for fellowship and exercise, which is a very good thing to do, but you'd have to play on Buddhist principles. If the other team wanted the ball, compassion, come on, let go. Pass it to them. If they can't score themselves, you score it for them, own goal. Isn't it important to let go? That's why we don't have Buddhist soccer teams. They'll always lose. But anyway. So when I was rowing, I remember, if you ever done that at university or at school, it's very hard work because, you know, you do these races, you really have to row very hard. And I remember once there was a coach who was on the footpath and he shouted at me. He said, "You're making an ugly face. Smile for goodness sake." And that was actually the first time I followed his advice. I smiled and the oar was easier to pull. It's true. You try it. At work, whatever you have to do, if you make an ugly face, the work is harder. If you smile, it's much easier to do. Just like that story in Thailand, when my teacher, Ajahn Chah, was building his main meditation hall. It was also the Upostha Hall, the Sima Hall. And because it was a low land and sometimes got flooded, he built it on like a hill. Not a man-made hill, a monk-made hill. You know, we had to do all the wheelbarrowing, but I missed out on that part of it. But I went to visit just after the thing was finished, and there was a big mound of earth left over. And Ajahn Chah, we only eat one meal a day, and that was finished about 9:30. And he, after the meal, he brought us all together and said, "I want you to move that pile of earth, because it's ugly where it is, over to the back of the hall." And he showed us where he wanted us to move it. That was a big pile of dirt. But you know, this was my teacher. I had a lot of faith. You know, my teacher had done so much for me. I didn't mind spending 3 days, that's how long it took, pushing, you know, all this earth in wheelbarrows. And that was from 9:30 in the morning, finishing maybe about 10 o'clock at night. And I was a Westerner, Ang Mo. I was being bitten by mosquitoes, sweating. I'm not used to that climate. I'm pushing the wheelbarrows through the mosquito-infested forest monasteries, sweating, dirty. For 3 days I did that. But after the third day, we'd finished. And I thought, tomorrow I'll be able to wash my robes, you know, have a bit of a rest and get back on my meditation. But that night, Ajahn Chah left for another monastery. And the following morning, the deputy abbot, the number two in charge, who was now in charge, he called all us monks together and he said, "I've been thinking, where you put the earth, it's still ugly. I think we should move it to another place." You know, he had a point. You know, actually, where Ajahn Chah said wasn't a nice place. And the other place, which his second monk suggested, was a good place. So 3 more days of pushing these heavy wheelbarrows from 9:30 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night with only one meal a day. Oh, you got so tired and dirty, but I still had faith. And we finished it. So after another 3 days, I was really dirty. Because you had no time to wash your robes and you were really filthy. You managed to have a shower at the end of the day, but it was very filthy. But that night, Ajahn Chah came back. So the following morning, after breakfast, he told us all, "I told you to move the earth over to there. You put it over this other place. Move it back." So another 3 days were in front of me, pushing these stupid barrows of earth. I never became a monk to do this. And those senior monks, they don't have to push the earth. They just sit in their rooms all day talking to people. Whereas monks like me had to do all the hard work, and I was very upset. They should decide where they want to put the earth and talk to each other before they get us to do all the hard work. Another 3 days of very hard labor was in front of me. And that was the point where I lost my faith. And again, I started swearing. Stupid monks. It was really hard work. And, you know, you were thin, you were weak, you didn't have much food. And then one of the Thai monks saw that I was unhappy. And he came up to me and gave me a teaching which I will always remember and thank him for. He said, "Pushing the wheelbarrows is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part." And I understood that straight away. And I stopped complaining, stopped thinking about it. And the wheelbarrows got much lighter to push. And the 3 days passed very quickly. And this time, we didn't have to move that damn pile of earth anymore. It was finished. And to this day, I think those two monks planned it to begin with. Just to give us a practical lesson. That all the problems in your life, thinking about it is the hard part. Doing it is very easy. Whether it's an operation you're about to have, whether it's changing job, whether it's, you know, asking somebody you love to marry you, whatever it is, thinking about it, that's always the difficult part. Doing it is very easy. And that's what I learned. And it means whether it's giving talks, whether it's going to see the doctor, whether it's doing interviews on TV, I'm totally relaxed. Because you don't think about it. You just do it. And this talk is sponsored this evening by Nike. Just do it. Now, so that's developing the banana mouth. Now, one of the problems is, you know, I can come here and give all these lovely talks, tell you about the two fingers and smiling and don't think so much. And what happens when I go away? You forget it all and you go back to normal again. So why don't you actually start doing something about, you know, this Buddhism and actually practice? You know, it works. Even like meditating. Why can't you start doing some meditation? Each one of you, it's good for you and it's easy to do. And the trouble is, because you've all got what we call monkey minds. You know what a monkey mind is? This is my next banana simile. Buddhism and bananas. Bananas, again, are very profound, as you will now find out. There was a monkey, and this story was from Sri Lanka. It could very well be here in Kotakinabalu, because you've got monkeys as well, haven't you? Well, let's make it Kotakinabalu. So, one day, the monkey came to the temple. It came to Santawana Hermitage, because the monkey knew this was Waisak Day, and on Waisak Day, lots and lots of people come to the hermitage and bring lots of food. And because there's so many people and so much food, there's opportunity for the monkeys to find something which is dropped or even steal some food. So the monkey came, tried to steal some food, you know, from one of the people who brought it to the hermitage on the Waisak Day. But as he was waiting for someone to drop some food, he happened to hear the monk giving a sermon. And that monk was talking about meditation. And the monk mentioned monkey mind. And the monkey said, wow, they're talking about me. So the monkey went to listen. But when he heard the monk saying, a monkey mind is a bad mind. It's a mind which is bad for meditation. It's a mind which you have to get rid of to make sure that you can be peaceful and still and not have a monkey mind. The monkey got very annoyed. What's wrong with a monkey mind? Said the monkey. I'm a monkey. Monkey minds are good. These monks, they're defaming us. They're saying rotten things about us. They shouldn't do this. I'm very upset. I'm going to complain. There's nothing wrong with monkey mind. These monks, they should be kinder to us monkeys. And so he swung back to his troop of monkeys in the forest to complain. And he told the head monkey and all his friends, you wouldn't believe what these Buddhist monks are saying about us. They say our minds are stupid, are restless, are bad, are terrible, and we shouldn't have monkey minds. That is defamation. That is libel. We shouldn't stand for this. We've got to do something about this. And all the monkeys agreed. Yeah, those monks, they don't respect monkeys. You know, we're very close together. There's only two letters that separates us. And there's nothing wrong with a monkey mind. You know, we should stand up for our rights and do something about this. And they're always jumping up and down protesting. And then the head monkey said, see? That's what a monkey mind is. Jumping up and down, all excited.
Nor the monkey said, my goodness, you're right. We've got monkey minds because we're monkeys. And that's a terrible thing. What are we going to do?
And the head monkey, he was very old and very wise. And so he said, look, I've also been to Santawana Hermitage and listened to the head monk give Dhamma talk. And I've heard him say that if you learn how to meditate, then you can overcome the monkey mind. So let's all meditate. And all the monkeys jumped up and down and said, yes, we'll meditate. Yes, we'll meditate. We're going to meditate. Monkey mind again, sit down. Now, the head monkey said, now I've seen how these yogis in the hermitage meditate. They get nice cushions first of all. So go and find some grass and make a cushion. So they all went into the forest. They took some grass and some leaves and made it into a nice cushion and put it in the clearing where they live. Now what do we do? Now what do we do? Said monkeys. Now what you do next is you sit down. So they all sat down. Right leg over left leg. Right paw over left paw. Back straight, head down. Close your eyes, watch your breath. So that was the first time monkeys ever tried Anapanasati. Meditating on their breath. It's amazing. But being monkeys, after 30 seconds, one monkey raised its paw. Excuse me, said this monkey. And everybody opened their eyes. What? And this monkey said, look, I've been thinking, you know, we agreed today that for lunch, we're going to raid the banana plantation to get some bananas for lunch. And I keep thinking about that. So why don't we go and raid the banana plantation first? You know, get it out of the way. And then we can meditate. Yeah, good idea, said the monkeys. Yeah, let's go and raid the banana plantation. So they all got up from their meditation. And they all swang through the trees to the banana plantation. They stole many, many bananas. And they brought them back to the clearing. But it wasn't lunch yet, so they can't eat it. They put all these bananas into a big pile. And then they went back on their meditation cushions. Because they got it out of the way. Right leg over left leg. Right paw over left paw. Back straight, head down, watching their breath. After 30 seconds. Excuse me, said one of the monkeys. I've been thinking. You know, before we eat those bananas, we have to peel them first. I keep thinking about that. So let's all get that out of the way, first of all. We won't eat it, we'll just peel the bananas. So I don't have to think about it. Then I can meditate peacefully. Yeah, good idea, said all the monkeys. So they all got up from their meditation cushions. And they got the bananas and peeled all the bananas, put them in this big heap, so they didn't need to think about that anymore. And they went back to sit meditation. Right leg over left leg, right paw over left paw, back straight, head down, watching their breath, breathing in, breathing out. Excuse me, said another monkey. I've been thinking. You know, before we eat those bananas, we've already peeled them. We have to put them in our mouth first. Let's get that out of the way. Yes, said all the other monkeys. We won't eat them, we just put them in our mouth. So all the monkeys got up and they all put a banana in their mouth. Now, three monkeys put two bananas in their mouth. You know what some people are like. Just like monkeys. And then they all went back to their meditation cushions with bananas in their mouths. Closed their eyes. Left leg over right leg. Another way around. Right leg over left leg. Right paw over left paw. Back straight. Heads down. Closed their eyes. And of course, as soon as they closed their eyes, they ate all the bananas. And that is what we mean by a monkey mind. Let's get all this work out of the way and then I'll meditate. Let's get all the housework out of the way and then we'll go to the temple. We can't come this evening to this talk. We've got so many things to do. Let's get them out of the way first and then we'll have some peace. No, get peace out of the way first. Get meditation out of the way first. Not all these other things you have to do in life. Now that is the real meaning of the monkey mind. It's why many people never meditate. why they never go to the temple, why they never keep precepts or give generous donations. They've got too many other things to get out of the way first. They never get round to it. That is the problem. Even the Aloka Foundation, they're trying to build a new retreat center, always trying to collect money. So I like to tell the story of the suicidal spider. Once there was a spider, and this spider was just born, and he went to make a nice home in the corner of a room in someone's house. And this spider, he worked so hard making a beautiful web. He was careful, mindful. So the web was delightful when it was finished. And as soon as it was finished, he sat in the middle, admiring his new home and waiting for lunch. But before lunch could come, before he could even rest, the woman of the house saw there was a spider web in the room and got a broom and smashed the web to bits. And the spider had to run for his life. Imagine that. You build your first house, and as soon as it's finished, somebody smashes it to bits. That's what it's like being a spider. But he didn't give up. He went to the house next door, built another web, and think, oh, this time I'm going to be lucky. And as soon as the web was finished, he sat in the middle, and again the husband saw it, smashed it to bits. Again he had to run for his life. Third house, fourth house. Now four is always unlucky. And he decided, eighth house, because eight is a lucky number. But even the eighth house, the maid, because it was a rich house, because you know, only rich people can buy houses with number eights. They had a maid. And the maid smashed the web to bits. Eight houses. Eight webs he'd built. And not one had survived more than 5 minutes. And he hadn't had anything to eat at all. And after eight houses, he gave up. What's the point of building another web? You put all this effort and energy into things, and these human beings, they smash my house to bits, and I never have anything to eat. No one likes spiders. And the spider started to cry. It's so bad karma to be spider. No one likes you. And he got very depressed. Unfortunately, they don't have psychiatrists to treat depressed spiders. So he decided to commit suicide. He walked down the road and he tried to get under somebody's shoes. But every time he got between the place between the sole and the heel, so he never got squashed. He tried to cross the road and get under the tire of a car or a truck, but he always got in the middle. He couldn't even commit suicide properly. That was really depressing. So the poor suicidal spider, he was really depressed, hungry, rejected, alone. No one loved him. And he was staggering down the road, crying, sad, depressed. He was a suicidal spider. And then he came across a fat spider. The fat spider was sunning himself in the afternoon sun with a big smile on his face. And when he saw the suicidal spider crying, the fat jolly spider said, "What's wrong with you?" And suicidal spider told the story of his sad life. Eight houses destroyed, never having anything to eat, hungry, thin, depressed, no one loves me. And then suicidal spider noticed that the fat spider was happy and was really fat. And suicidal spider asked, how come you're so fat and happy? And the fat jolly spider said, well, when I was born, I just made one web. And it's been there for months. And I catch lots of food. Actually, I'm so content and I have so much food, you can come and stay with me. There's enough food for both of us. And the suicidal spider, this is really strange. Where have you built a web where no one disturbs it? So you've been able to catch so much food over all these years, all these months. And the fat jolly spider said, oh, I made a web in the donation box of a local foundation. No one ever disturbs me there. Is that true? No, please, be kind and disturb the spiders in the donation box. But anyway, back to bananas. So if you want to be generous now. Get it out of the way. And then you can do all the other things. If you're going to keep precepts, do it now. Don't wait. If you want to start meditating, do it now. Don't get all these other things out of the way and then I'll meditate. Otherwise it never happens. You know, certainly in the West, in the Christian tradition anyway, you know the only place you find in places like Australia, the only places where you find people resting in peace is in the cemetery. And it's too late by then. So see if you can rest in peace before you die, when you can still enjoy it. So get peace out of the way, first of all. So, a good example, when you go home tonight, when you look at all the dishes, the dirty dishes in the sink in your kitchen, and you think, oh, I must clean all these up first of all, before you meditate. No. Count how many dishes are in the sink, dirty. Compare that to how many dishes are clean. And if the clean ones outnumber the dirty ones, quit while you're ahead. Otherwise you'll be compulsive doers and you never enjoy anything in life. I've got a saying. Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. It's very profound. Very good. Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. That's true, you know. So please enjoy your life. Make peace. Do things which are really important. And then you understand that you are not a monkey mind anymore. You're a wise mind. So the next banana simile, which is incredibly profound, was all about attachments. You may have heard in the ancient times how the hunters would catch monkeys. It was a very simple thing to do. All they did in the ancient days was get a coconut shell. They'd hollow out the coconut, you know, drink the milk and the flesh. And so they'd have a coconut with a little hole in the front. And they'd tie that coconut with a firm rope to a tree. And they'd put a banana in the coconut. Now the hole was just big enough for a monkey to put their paw in. But not big enough that the monkey could pull the paw with the banana in. And that's all they needed to do. And they left the banana in the coconut overnight. And sure enough, a monkey would find the banana and put the paw in and try and get the banana out. But the monkey wasn't smart enough to get the banana out because the hole was too big to get the paw out clutching a banana. The hole was too small, sorry. And when the hunter came, the monkey saw the hunter coming and knew it was either going to be killed or captured. And all that monkey needed to do was to let go of the banana and he could take his paw out and run away. But could the monkey let go of the banana? No, just the monkey tried harder to pull the banana out with the fist and could not do it. And that's how the monkeys got caught. Why? Because the monkey thought, that's my banana, I found it. Which is why it got attached and couldn't let it go. Many monkeys got caught that way. Like many people, I go traveling a lot on aircraft. Have you ever listened to the emergency message? If you have to evacuate, leave all your personal belongings on board. Can people do that? No, because that's my computer, that's my bag. And that kills you and other people. Why do you do that? There have been many people who have died. They run into the house when it's a light, trying to collect their personal belongings, and it kills them. You can see how attachment can actually kill you. So be very careful. It's not your house. It's not your banana. Every time you think it's mine, that's when you get into trouble. What about your kids? Are they your kids? Of course they're not. They come into your life. They're there for 18, 20 years. You teach them everything. You look after them. Then you should let them go. Bye-bye, son. I've looked after you enough. Get out. Because that's what the birds do. I've seen birds in nature. They look after their children. They sit on those hard eggs. If you think meditation is hard on a cushion, imagine sitting on round eggs for 2 days. Those birds might go through a lot of trouble. And then the birds, once they're hatched, they have to find food for the little birds all day. And then they have to teach them how to fly. But the birds are smart, because as soon as the bird can actually fly, that's it, out of the nest, and mum and dad goes off on holiday. But human beings? No. Kids 20, 30, 40, and they're still staying at home. Why? It's because my son, my daughter, that's the problem. Please let them go. If you know how to let things go, you don't get caught like the monkey gets caught. If you can let your possessions go, then you can actually escape from the burning plane. Actually, on the subject of plane disasters, I travel a lot. You know, I've got frequent flyer points. I've got so many frequent flyer points now because I travel around the world a lot. I've almost got enough of my own aircraft. But many of my disciples, they're afraid. They say, Ajahn Brahm, you shouldn't fly so much because there are terrorists who like blowing up planes. That's why you have to go through all this security. But I don't mind. A long time ago I said, look, I'm not at all worried if I die in aircraft explosion. Because I saw there are three advantages, three benefits of dying in aircraft explosion at 30,000 feet. The first advantage, instant cremation. If ever you've organized a funeral for your mother or your father, oh, it's so much work. Arranging this and arranging that. This is done on the job, on the spot. It's efficient. That's first advantage. I don't have to worry my relations about arranging the funeral. It's all done on the spot. Number two, how much do funerals cost in Sabah? Feeding all your friends, and sometimes they're not even your friends, they still come for the feast. And getting all the monks to do the chanting, and the cremation itself, the coffin is really expensive. Everything costs such a lot of money. But if you die in aircraft explosion, not only do you spend no money, but actually your family get money from insurance, from aircraft company. So that's the second advantage. Actually, your family makes some money out of your death instead of having to spend half the family fortune. But the best advantage is number three. Because if you die at 30,000 feet, you're so close to heaven, it's easy to go the rest of the way. So why be afraid of dying in aircraft explosion? three advantages. That's positive thinking. So, but you know, the banana thing is all about it. Why won't the monkey let go of the banana? You know, a lot of times that's what happens to people. There's a car crash, they won't get out of the car. They won't let go of things which are causing them problems. Why all that pain and difficulties of the past? Why can't you let it go? They're killing you. All that anger about what somebody else has done to you and how they've hurt you. Why can't we just let it go? It's killing you. Why all of the guilt? You may have done some bad things. Why can't you let it go? Now, one of the things I was really impressed with Buddhism, there was no punishment. It was weird. But if you look at the Vinaya, all you have to do, if a monk makes a mistake, they acknowledge it to another monk. There's total forgiveness, because the Buddha said if you acknowledge your mistakes and you know, try to find some strategy so you don't do it again, that's called growth in the Aryan Vinaya, in the Aryan discipline. There's no punishment. And that was such a relief to me. So to tell you what I mean, when I became head monk, the abbot of monastery in Serpentine, we have our training that you have to spend 1 year in 8 precepts wearing white before you can become novice monk. And then another 12 months as a novice before you can take full ordination as a monk. It's called QC, quality control. So 2 years you have to train before you can even become bhikkhu. So it's very tough. And as the first year, you have to keep 8 precepts, and some of you know that one of those precepts is not eating in the afternoon. Now one day, this person in training in his first year, he came to see me one day to confess. He said the previous day, in the afternoon, he got very, very hungry. And he snuck into our kitchen when no one saw. And he made himself a sandwich and ate it. He'd broken his precepts. And he felt so guilty, he couldn't sleep well the night before. So he came to me to confess he'd eaten in the afternoon. So I told him, wonderful, you've confessed your offense. That's what you should do. Now there's no punishment, but I'm going to give you some strategies. For example, eat more at lunchtime, so you're not so hungry in the afternoon. And if you are hungry, you can have some fruit juice, you can have some tea, some chocolate in our monastery. There's many things you can drink, some honey if you're very hungry, just to fill yourself up, so you can do those things, okay? Now you can go. And this Australian man said, aren't you going to punish me? He said, no. And the Australian said, that's not good enough. So he said, if you don't give me a penance, I will do it again. That's what Australians are like. So he put me on the spot. I had to think of a punishment for him so that he could learn not to do it again. As it happened, that day I was reading a history book about the early years of Australia. And many of you would know it started off as a prison colony. And the soldiers who were running that colony were very fierce on any prisoner who broke a rule. They would get flogged. And they would use what they'd called a cat of nine tails, this whip with 9 thongs. And I'd just been reading it that morning. So I told this young Australian man, I said, if you want a punishment, I will give you a traditional Australian punishment. I will give you 50 strokes of the cat. And this man, his face went white. His lips started to quiver. He thought, oh my God, I'm going to be flogged. I'm going to be whipped. That's not what I wanted. And then I told him what 50 strokes of the cat means in a Buddhist monastery. We had 2 cats. Find one of them and stroke it. 1, 2. Learn some compassion. and kindness. That's your penance. So you can forgive yourself. You know, one of the reasons, why can't we let things go and forgive ourselves, forgive them? A lot of times we think it's my fault. It's not your fault. There's many, many reasons why we did those mistakes. You were hungry. Be kind to yourself. Let it go. And you will find if you're kind, you'd never do it again. If you punish yourself, you think you're worthless, you do it again. That's why forgiveness is so powerful psychologically. We can let it go. And that's why the Buddha said, no punishment. Acknowledgement, amnesty, and learning never to do it again. That's all that's needed. What a beautiful world it would be if we had such letting go. So you can see the talk on Buddhism and bananas. There are many wonderful teachings which I've taught about bananas or banana-related things. And I did this because there's many, many talks you hear, but maybe this is the first time you've heard a talk about Buddhism and bananas and how useful it can be. So thank you for listening. So now, we have any questions on bananas or Buddhism, whichever you wish.
Those of you who want to ask questions, there will be wireless mic provided by the working team. Please speak into the mic so that we can capture your question clearly. Any questions?
Okay, if you have a question on anything, as well as bananas.
While waiting, Achan. Yesterday there was a question.
Okay. Yesterday question, yeah.
How to be a vegetarian?
How do we eat vegetarian?
How to be a vegetarian?
How to be a vegetarian is eat vegetables. So do I eat bananas?
Bananas okay?
Bananas okay, yeah.
Question?
Hi. Testing, yeah, hi. Ajahn Brahm, thank you for your wonderful talk. I'm very interested in this question of attachment.
Very good.
Because I find, I'm sure most of us do, that we have attachments.
Yeah.
And we're attached to the idea of attachment. And I just find it, is it difficult? How far are we supposed to go to not be attached to things? You know, I mean, I like Arsenal Football Club, and I get annoyed when they lose, and I bang the chair, and I, you know, my heart goes boom, 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 or whatever when they concede a goal. That's an attachment. And to some people, not having
okay.
Void of passion.
Yeah, okay. I think I got the question. Well, actually, I can see that, you know, you're from your accent, you're from London?
Norfolk,
okay, that's close enough. I was from West London. So, well, as a young man, I supported Fulham. Yeah, I know, but they kept on losing when I was young. That's why I became a monk. Too much suffering. So that's why you have much more fun when you have few attachments. So these days, what I usually do, if you hear a soccer match, you find out who's winning at half time, and I support that team. And that way you're always on the winning end. Isn't that wonderful? You can have much more fun that way. Because, you know, what attachment is, you want one team to win and not another team to win. Which means that you can't really let go and enjoy your life. Now, and you may have read a book, you know, called Who Moved My Cheese? A very famous book. That's why a lot of times we're attached to plans of the future. Now that's one of the attachments which we should really let go of. Any plan you have for the future, make it very, very plastic, so that you can let go and change at a moment's notice. That's what they said about who moved my cheese. Life is always changing. It's always fluid. Economies come, economies go. Stock market is anicca. It goes up and down like everything else. And if you have a very solid plan, you miss too many opportunities. Don't be attached to plans. Always be able to change at a moment's notice. I've seen many, many people, I go traveling a lot, when the plane gets delayed. A few years ago I was flying to Indonesia on Garuda. And the plane was delayed for 24 hours. That was because of the time of bird flu. Garuda is a bird and it got the bird flu. No, it wasn't that. But I saw other people, they went to the counter, they got banging on, you can't do this to me, I've got an important appointment. They didn't make the plane come quicker, it just gave them sore hand. Have you seen that happen? What a waste of time it is. So, when there's nothing you can do, you have to let it go. And I've also seen, even more importantly, people you love, you're so attached to, that when they're about to die, you don't let them go. Now I've seen this is serious, but it's a very beautiful. Once I was counseling a young man called Steve. He was a young man, only in his early 30s. He had a cancer and he was dying. So I was counseling him for many weeks. And, you know, he was very close to death. And I went to visit him in his apartment. His wife Jenny was there. And no, as a monk, you become very intuitive. I realized there was something wrong. And I realized what was happening was that I told Jenny, I said, have you given Steve permission to die yet? And she didn't answer me, she understood. Jenny and Steve, young married couple. Steve was so attached to Jenny and Jenny to Steve. They weren't letting Steve die. He was hanging on there because the worst thing he wanted to do was to hurt the one he loved the most. Jenny knew that, so she climbed onto the bed. It's one of these scenes I will never forget. They embraced and she looked into his eyes and said, Steve, I give you permission to die. Let go. It's okay. I will be fine. There's a beautiful moment where they both cried. He died the next day. It was the end of his pain and suffering. If she hadn't said that, he'd have probably lingered on for a week or 2 weeks, trying so hard to keep alive so he wouldn't hurt the one he loved the most in the world, his wife. Now, that would have been attachment, which is very different than love. Love is learning how to let people go. When it's time to go, you go with my blessing. I love you so much, I set you free. It's a higher form of love. The attachment is like putting someone in a prison. You have to be here for me. That's not real love at all. So now you're going into the very higher passions. Compassion. So when you don't have any attachments, it doesn't mean you're like some automaton, some robot. It means you can love and let go without attachment. When my father died, I loved my father very much. I was only 16 when he died. But when he died, I never felt sad. I never cried. It was a strange experience for a 16-year-old to go to my father's cremation and not shed a tear, even though I loved him immensely. And it took me many years to understand what I was feeling. And the way you understand emotions is you find another emotion which is similar. And the emotion which was similar, which I recognized was exactly how I felt at my father's funeral, was a simile of the concert. As a young man, you know, growing up in London, it was in the 60s, used to see all these great concerts. I saw the very, very first concert of Led Zeppelin. I also went to see this concert of only six of us turned up to watch. And I thought the band wouldn't play, you know, just for six people. You know, the lead singer was Rod Stewart. You'd be lucky to get a seat amongst 6,000 these days. He's very popular. So I remember all those concerts and performances in those days. But at the end of the concert, we'd all stand up, clap, shout for more. And the band or the orchestra would always play the encore. But after the encore was finished, the band had to go home, and so would I. And as I walked out of those clubs, theatres, concert halls of London, I always remember it was dark, wet. It was always raining, you know, the drizzle of London. Always gloomy. And even though I knew the concert was over, never once did I cry at the end of a great concert. I never felt sad after going to a wonderful performance. And that's exactly how I felt when my father died. What a great concert that was. What a great performance. How lucky I was to be there for 16 years. There was no sadness. There was gratitude. Thank you for being my dad for 16 years. And I enjoyed that time so much. Like a great concert. I never, even I've been a monk 37 years, and this was 45 years ago. It was 40 years ago when I went to these concerts. I still remember them. I still even remember the music. Can't forget it. Just like my father's life. What a great concert, Dad. I let him go with happiness. That's a different way. Attachment is keeping them there, giving yourself pain, and giving them pain too. So have the compassion of going to a concert, enjoying the time you have with people, enjoying the time you have today, knowing it's going to end. And when you walk out of today, you walk out, what a wonderful time we've had together. That's how you let go. So, thank you for giving me the time to answer that question.
Thank you. I'm not sure if this is a question. What's written here on the note is, kindly share with us the personal, private meditation timetable, Ajahn Chah, his time and usual location. Thank you.
Okay. He'd only meditate now. That's the schedule which monks have. There's only one time, and that's now. So that's the only time to meditate, now. All these schedules in the future and the past, we don't do those. I was telling someone today, when I teach meditation retreats, many of you may know that we do what's called noble silence. You know what noble silence means? No bell silence. We don't have any bells in my meditation retreats, no schedules. When people say, what time should I meditate? Now. When they ask me, what time is it? I say, now minutes past, the now for hour, the now for day, the now for month, 2000 and now. To try and get rid of these ideas of schedules. Because when you want to meditate, you want to let go of time and be natural. There's a great story. Please don't mind me going on a bit. One of my favorite stories is a story of the Emperor's Three Questions. As a student, I read this in a book by Leo Tolstoy. And this gives you as much religion as you would ever need. I don't care if you're a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Christian. This is the heart of all those great teachings. It spans religions. Because there was an emperor who got fed up with organized religion. Always arguing with each other. Who's got the best religion? So he decided to find his own religion. So he thought, discussed, and realized, for religion and for life, there's only three questions you have to find the answers for. And those three questions were, when is the most important time? Who
is the most important person? And what is the most important thing to do? The when, the who, the what. And in this story by Tolstoy, the emperor eventually found the answer just in an incident in his life. I won't go through the whole story, just the answers to the emperor's three questions. When is the most important time? Answer? That's the only time you ever have. So when is the most important time to tell your wife, your husband sitting next to you, how much you love them? So go and do it. You know, I mean that. Tell them. They appreciate that because the moment disappears. When is the most important time to say sorry? The moment passes. You feel so much better and lighter if you apologize, if you've done something wrong. Now, when's the most important time to meditate? Now, when's the most important time to make a donation to a local foundation? Oh, when the economy goes up. Now is the most important time to do anything. Now the next question is the most profound. Who is the most important person? Ajahn Brahm. Who's the most important person? Yourself. Put your hand up if you think that's the answer. Yourself. You're all wrong. No, that's not the right answer. The most important person is the one you're with. The person in front of you. For me, but now you're the most important person. Now that's about what mindfulness is. You're aware of the person right in front of you. So if you're talking with somebody, how many of you have talked with someone, they're not listening? It means you're not important. Husbands and wives, you take each other for granted too much. So when your wife is talking to you, it's just her again. What she's rabbiting on about this time. No. If she's the one in front of you, she is the most important person in the world right now. You give her that importance, and then she'll realize that you respect her. When he is talking to you, if he's in front of you, he's the most important person in the world right now. Listen. Then you'll have a wonderful relationship together. If your kid is in front of you, don't think you're too busy. If they're in front of you right now, they are the most important person in the world. One of the disciples in Penang, working for a big company, she told me she got this huge promotion. She was in public relations. And she came to thank me because she was using that simile. The one in front of her was the most important person in the world. So it was a client or a boss. She related to them. The clients realized they were important. So she listened. The bosses realized that they were respected. She listened. And that's why she got this great promotion. So wonderful. Those of you in business who want to motivate your staff, tell them the Emperor's three questions. The one in front of you is the most important person in the world. When you close your eyes and I meditate, I can't see any of you. The one in front of me is me. Now I am important. And what's the most important thing to do? The answer was to care. I've told that to many doctors. Because I get disappointed in the West when somebody gets close to dying. The doctors intervene so aggressively. They put all these tubes into a person, try to keep them alive. Because they think that curing a person is the most important thing to do. It's not. A doctor's main task in life is to care, not to cure. And if you care for your patients, if they die, they survive, it's not that important. They've been cared for. And that's the most important thing. I know many doctors, young doctors, and they come to me and they feel so depressed. They've had, you know, say a patient, maybe a young mother, and they try to keep that girl alive, and they die. and they have to tell their husband who's got young kids, the kids have got no mum anymore. And they feel such a failure. And I tell them, look, you're a doctor. You will never be able to succeed in life as a doctor if you think you have to cure. Because sometimes you will fail, you won't be able to cure. But you will always be able to care. You'll never need to fail if you think that your main object is to care. And you will find that if you make caring more important than curing, you'll have a far more fulfilling career. And actually, you will actually heal more people as well. And when they do die, they will die knowing they've been cared for. What a wonderful gift you've given them as a doctor. The most important thing to do in life is to care, not to cure. What beautiful teachings. The Emperor's three questions. Most important thing, most important time is now. The most important person is the one you're with. The most important thing to do is to care. You know, that's all the religion you need.
Thank you, Ajahn. Any questions from the floor?
Okay, got some piece of paper coming up. Don't worry about the anonymous questions because you've all registered and we can compare your handwriting to find out who asked those questions.
Venerable Ajahn Brahm,
yeah.
Can you share your thoughts with us on the issue of abortion?
Okay, yeah. The issue of abortion. Number one, there is a saying in the Vinaya that a human being begins when consciousness first manifests in the mother's womb. That's actually the saying of the beginning of human life. When consciousness first manifests. There's the word patubhavoti in Pali. First appears. Now, for consciousness to first appear in the mother's womb, it means that that fetus has to develop a nervous system, a basic nervous system, so they can actually show a response to pleasure or pain. I was talking to the doctor this morning, who said maybe about 2 months. Maybe that's the time. I thought it was much later, when the nervous system is mature enough for consciousness to manifest. Before that time, it's not regarded as a human being, according to that definition of the Buddha. So you're not killing a human being before that time. So that certainly does mean that things like intrauterine devices, contraceptives, are not a problem according to Buddhism. That is not, you don't have to worry about that at all. That is not killing. That is, the human being hasn't been formed yet, according to the Buddhist definition. Number two, now with abortions, I have met many women, because it's part of my job, who have sought counseling. They've either had abortions or they're seeking to have one. And they come for advice. And I know that it's the most difficult decision a woman will ever make. And as a man, I think, I don't know what you're going through. I will never know what you're going through. So my job is to support you, not to tell you what to do, and certainly never to criticize you. Most of those rules have been made by men who have never been pregnant. Basically, they don't know what they're talking about. And a woman who's got a being in their womb growing is one of the most difficult decisions she will ever have to make in her life. She never makes that easily. So you have to go back to basic law of karma. Why are you doing that? The Buddha said if you're going to make a difficult decision, make sure you're not following what he called the four agati. Make sure you're never acting out of desire, you know, what your personal wants, nor out of ill will. know, you hate that babe, or you hate the father, or you hate, not out of ill will, not out of stupidity. In other words, to find out exactly what's going on as best you can. Explore all the options. But most importantly, the fourth thing you should consider and never act out of is fear. And unfortunately, in our modern societies, most women, when they have to make a decision about abortion, are consumed by fear. Fear of what other people will think or say to them. Or fear of, you know, some legal or karmic consequences. Fear of making a sin. That should never be what drives your decision making. So this is what the Buddha said. Never act out of fear. Never act out of stupidity or delusion. Never act out of ill will. Never act out of craving or desire. So that's how you can help a woman make that decision. And that's all I tell them. Look at those four things and make your decision. And please know that whatever decision you make, I will always be your friend, support you. Because I know that decision will never be easy. And if you do decide for an abortion, it's a tough decision you have to make. And I know I get a feeling for what you have to go through. And I'll be there for you to support you. Never to criticize you. Never to make you feel guilty. Never to make you feel bad about yourself. Acknowledge, forgive, and learn. Please try to make some strategies so you never get yourself in that position again. Use contraceptives. Be careful, you know, when you go out with somebody. You don't take alcohol or drugs and get yourself in that position. Now make sure you go avoid places where, you know, women might get raped. Do whatever you can. But the job of a monk is not to tell a woman what to do. Give her a helping hand so she knows how to make those decisions. Whatever decision she makes, never be critical, but be compassionate. You know, some men tried to kill the Buddha, assassinate him. And when they came to confess that they went to assassinate him, the Buddha never called the police, never criticized him, just, good, you're acknowledged, you're forgiven. He taught them the Dhamma and they became stream winners. That's the way of Buddhism. Compassion, wisdom, never criticizing. It's a tough decision you have to make. And our job is not to criticize you. I'm sure there'll be many women here who have had abortions. Please, you are good Buddhists. Many, many things you may do in your life. Some of the wrong things, some of the right things, but never think that one bad thing makes you a bad Buddhist. Look, I've been to many prisons, as we were saying earlier. I never once, in all my life in prison, never once seen a criminal. I've never seen a murderer. I've never seen a thief. I've never seen a rapist. I've seen a person who was killed, but I've never seen a murderer. I've seen a person who's stolen, never a thief. I've seen a person who's raped, but never a rapist. Because they're much more than their crime. They may have murdered one person, that does not make them a murderer. They are a person who's murdered. They're much bigger than that one act. If you have done an abortion, you're much bigger than that one act. Never think that that's bad me, bad me. And just criticize yourself because of one maybe difficult decision. You understand that, you understand what forgiveness means. There's no such thing as a murderer. There's no such thing as a liar. There are people who tell lies. They're not liars. If you understand what I mean, you understand the way forward. You know, I told that simile a couple of years ago at the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. And after my talk, the doctor who was the head of the schizophrenic unit came to see me. And I asked him, he complimented me on my talk. He was a Christian, but he asked me to come and bless his ward because he was impressed with the talk. And then I just happened to ask him, how do you treat schizophrenia in your institute? And he replied, we don't treat schizophrenia. We treat the other part of their patient. And I put my hands up and said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu to him. There's no such thing as a schizophrenic. There's a person who suffers episodes of schizophrenia. If you treat them as a person, treat the other part of them, then you have state-of-the-art treatment. I asked him, how's your success rate? He said, brilliant. Much better than expected if you treat the schizophrenia with all this medication. We're treating the other part of the patient. So I said, Sadhu, you've got it, you've understood. There's no such thing as a schizophrenic. There's no such thing as a murderer or a liar. It's just a person who's told a lie. You understand that? You understand the psychology of the mind and how we can forgive, move beyond the faults, focus on the other part, and his growth. So excuse me again for going on that, but that's an important part of Dhamma.
Thank you, Adam. Next question I have here is, based on the downturn of world scenario, example, global warming, earthquakes and famine, what is Ajahn's opinion?
Global warming, famine, why do we always focus on the negative part of life? It makes us really depressed. Yeah, I mean, sort of Arsenal, you know, they only drew with my old team as Fulham, but they're still much higher in the league. You should be very happy, they're doing well. So a lot of times it's very easy to get depressed. Global warming, there's a credit crisis, you know, in Europe because of the spending of the European governments. You know, the world is in depression around, crime is increasing, people are becoming more unfriendly, people are getting, the divorce rates getting up, there's AIDS, there's cancers, there's dengue fever. Why are people so negative? Once I arrived at Singapore to give a series of talks, they hired Suntec City Convention Center for me, expecting crowd up to 5,000 people, and they'd advertised on the back of buses. There's a saying in England, you've got a face like the back of a bus. That was actually true for me, because my face was on the back of buses in Singapore. But that was at height of the SARS crisis. On the flight from Perth to Singapore, I read the paper. Black letters on the front page, 99 cases of SARS. The Singapore government had closed all the schools, had advised to have no public gatherings. And so my organizers, the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, were waiting for me at the airport, very concerned, saying, shall we cancel? And imagine how much money they have to put up to hire a big auditorium for 5,000 people for 4 nights and all that advertising. So what I said, what's the population of Singapore? And they said at the time it was 4 million. So I said, that means 3,999,901 people haven't got SARS. And they got the message, let's go ahead. Because why is it 99 people have got SARS and people totally overreact? 3,999,901 haven't got SARS. That's, what is that? It's a 40,000 to 1 chance you're not going to get SARS. That's pretty good odds to me. So we went ahead. The first day only 2,000, built up. The last evening was 5,000 people. Total success.
And also, I told many jokes on purpose to get people to laugh because SARS was a respiratory disease. So I needed to strengthen people's lungs. So by coming to the talk and laughing a lot, they never got SARS. So I was actually helping. If they went home and got depressed, they get even more problems. So I went ahead.
Okay, we got a question from the gentleman.
Yeah, okay.
Can you just...
Hello. Oh. Good evening, Ajahn Brah. My apologies that I came in late. I became a Christian.
Yeah.
And then I sort of lost my way there a bit. And I find in Buddhism seems to be very enlightening to me. And it makes sense to me. Problem here is my whole family's become Christian. And I don't mean to be criticizing to any Christians here, forgive me, but I'm just stating the obvious that my family doesn't exactly see eye to eye in terms of the Buddhism way. For me and my girlfriend, we see it as purely as living life in the most simplest way. But to my family, they always say that God is a jealous God and everything else is wrong. So what can I do, Ajahn Brah?
What you can do, because as a person growing up in the West, I was exposed to Christianity, so I know the teachings. Didn't the golden rule say to love your neighbor as yourself? So here in Sabah, your neighbors are Muslims, Buddhists, maybe some Hindus as well. So you should say you should follow your teacher and love the Buddhists as you'd love yourselves. No more, no less. There's a beautiful story which is about religious harmony. And it's the story of the old man and the violin. There was an old man who lived up in the mountains, in a little village. And he worked so hard for his children to make sure his children got a good education. Eventually went to the city to go to university. He sacrificed so much for his children so that when they graduated and got jobs and got established, they invited their father to come to the city for the first time. Now, he'd never been in a city before. He just lived up in the mountains, in the small villages. So when he came to the city, he saw these huge buildings and things which don't exist in the village. He didn't have a TV up there. So it was an eye-opener for him to see all these amazing things in the city. But one day, he was passing a house and he heard the most awful, terrible sound in his life. And he wanted to find out what was causing that terrible sound, even though it was very hard to listen to. And he went to the back room of a house, and there he saw a young boy playing a violin. And being an uneducated man from the mountains, he thought it was the violin's fault, that all violins sound like that. So he said, I never want to hear one of those violins ever again. The next day, the different part of the city, he heard the most beautiful sound. He followed that and found in the front room of a house there was an old woman playing a violin. But she was a maestro, someone who practiced her whole life on the violin. And when he saw that, he realized his mistake. It wasn't the violin's fault. It just, the young boy hadn't learned how to play it yet. And he said, that's the same with religions. We may criticize Christianity, Buddhism, Islam, Hinduism, whatever. But if you really find someone who knows their religion well, who's a maestro, they play so sweetly. So real Christians make great friends to Buddhists. We've got two monasteries in Western Australia, two real big monasteries. There's my monastery with 20 monks, and there's the Catholic Benedictine monastery. They've got about 10 monks. We always visit each other twice a year.
They come to see my monastery, which they came just about a month ago. We go and see them. We're the best of friends. And in fact, I was so friendly with the previous abbot, Abbot Placid, that we did many talks together. And we were really real friends. He was a Catholic, I was a Buddhist. And the other monks knew this so well that at his funeral service, he died last year, at the funeral mass in front of the Archbishop of Perth, the Catholic Archbishop, I was invited to be part of the ceremony and to say a few words. There, in a very high Catholic mass, for an important person, the abbot of the Catholic monastery, a Buddhist monk, also gave a speech. That is a person who knows their religion, how to play it sweetly. But there's a third day to that story. Because the next day the old man visited another part of the city and heard the most beautiful sound in the world, which easily surpassed the maestro playing the violin. It was the most wonderful sound he'd ever listened to. Even more beautiful than the sound of the mountain rivers after a heavy rainstorm, or the sound of the birds up in the mountain in the early morning. Even more thrilling than the sound of the breezes through the forests. It was the most wonderful sound in the world. That was an orchestra. It was the most wonderful sound for two reasons. First, every person playing an instrument in our orchestra was each a maestro of their own instrument. They practiced for years on their own instrument. And then they'd gone a step further. They'd learned how to play together in harmony, as an orchestra does. And that was even more beautiful than a soloist. And with the wisdom of people who haven't gone to university, the old man said, wouldn't that be wonderful if all the religions in the world would first of all master their own religion and then go that step further and learn to play together in harmony. What a wonderful world that would be. Please tell that story to your parents. The story of the old man in the valley.
Thank you, Achar. We have time for only one last question. Can you stand up?
What is Buddhism's view on human cloning?
Human cloning. It would be wonderful to clone more of me than you could have one in Kota Kinabalu, one in Singapore. No, all that cloning is just creating another body. The most important part of a person is their mind, their stream of consciousness, what the Christians would call their soul or whatever. You know, we have many different proton cars, all cloned, they all look the same. The most important thing is the driver behind the wheel. So you may make someone who looks exactly like Ajahn Brahm, but would be totally different in their personality. The body is only part of the person. The mind is more important. So cloning, you may clone two people, they're totally different characters. So there's nothing wrong with cloning. But I saw an article once, even if you clone two people, they actually don't even look the same. Because there was an experiment done with cloning a cat. And from this cat, they cloned another cat, and they had a picture of them. You know that scientists, they do have a sense of humor. So the clone, you know what it was called? Copycat. So they had the mother, or the original, of that copycat. They had a photo of them, they had different markings on their fur. The DNA was exactly the same, but the way it's expressed was different. So just if you clone someone, use the same DNA, the way it's expressed makes them even look differently. It's very fascinating. So there's nothing wrong with cloning. Clone as much as you like. But actually, that's another thing about, you know, global warming. You know, one of the problems with our world, with global warming, is there's too many people. So all the things you do in reducing your carbon footprint, the more people, the more carbon footprints there are. You may have a smaller carbon footprint, but with more feet, you're not going to reduce very much. So, I am doing my bit to reduce the global population. My solution is for all governments to make every second boy a monk and every second girl a nun. And that would reduce the population very quickly.
Go on. John, I would like to have an encore. One last question. I thought this is interesting. It's from last night's written question. You always concentrate on how important harmony is. How do you see all current political revolutions in the Middle East?
That's a very good question. It's sometimes revolutions are done out of desperation. And usually, there's an old poem I remember reading as a kid. You know, it was, how was it now? I was thinking in a minute who it was. It's very famous, I've forgotten now. But anyway, the poem went like this. Vengeance to the tyrant fled and caught the tyrant in his bed and slew the wicked tyrant's head and became a tyrant in his stead. Now that's history. You start a revolution and then the same problem happens later on. The problem is with the system, not with the people running the government. Now, as a monk, I can think outside the box, because I live outside the box. And one important thing which will help all of our political systems is to change the way democracy works. At the moment, people get elected on what they promise to do for the future. And they always break their promises. No matter what government in the world you look at. I never blame any politician for breaking their promises. I criticize them for making the promises in the first place. You cannot know what's going to happen in the future, what problems your country will have to face. But in ancient Rome, a person who was standing for election was called a candidate. And we use that word even today. And it comes from the Latin word candid, meaning white. Because any person standing for the Senate in ancient Rome would have to wear white to show they were standing for election and also as a symbol of their virtuous conduct in the past. And they would be elected not on what they promised to do in the future, but on all of their accomplishments in the past, especially their honesty, their hard work, and the wise things they put into practice. So it would be wonderful if we would elect our leaders not on what they promised to do for us in the future. Because all that is a competition who makes the biggest lie. But for what they've done in the past. In the same way, you select managers and CEOs and directors of companies, not on what they promised to do for that company, but on what they've achieved in the past. Just that much would actually change a lot of our politics. And get people who are the best for the system. Not promising, but people who have done the job in the past, who are competent, who are virtuous, people who we can trust to lead. That'll be number one. It also means we won't have so much corruption in our governments. Because we'd look at what they've done in the past, and if they'd had any corrupt behavior in the past, they would not get elected. Corrupt people know how to lie. and they tell you all these amazing promises, and they sell those promises to us, we believe them, and we get into big trouble. Number two, if you have shares in a company, the more shares you have, the more votes you have. But in life, everybody voting for a government has one vote each. Those of you who are 70 or 80 should only, maybe if you're over 70 or 80, no vote at all. 20-year-olds should have a full vote because they've got more shares in life than 80-year-olds have. The decision your leaders are going to make, they're going to affect you as a 20-year-old much more than if you're an 80-year-old. An 80-year-old, you're going to be out of here soon. So I think the vote should be weighted. Younger people should have more votes than elderly people. That too would change our politics. And the reason is they got more shares in life than elderly people have. Wouldn't that really change things a lot? So there's different ways you can think outside the box to actually change things. The other thing with multiracial harmony and multi-religious harmony, it's about time we stopped all religious schools. Because religious schools create what we call ghettos in society. There are some people, say in Australia, they go to a primary school of their religion. Then they go to a secondary school of the same religion. They go to a university just of their own religion. They marry people from their own religion. They go out with people from their own religion. They only know their own religion, nothing more. And that's why they can have a lot of misunderstandings. If you have a school with Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, non-believers of anything, all meeting together, playing soccer together, you know, having parties together, if those are your friends, you get to learn all the great things of the different religions of our world. You get to respect each other. And there will be no more violence between the religions. It's called social engineering. It's a good thing to do. Because the alternative is just people just knowing their own religion and nothing more. That's one of the big problems in our current world. That's one of the reasons why there is no Buddhist school in Australia. I've stopped it. I've said, no, we shouldn't do this. And I'm trying to say, let's stop the Christian schools as well. The Muslim schools. There's no Hindu school, I don't think. We've got many more Buddhists in Australia than Muslims. They've got schools. We haven't. We say, no, we don't want them. We want our Buddhists to go to schools with Muslims, Christians, everybody. For the sake of harmony. And then we won't have this violence towards this group or that group. So that's one way. It makes a lot of sense to me. I don't see why we can't do this. So as a monk, you think outside the box. Well, I've put this out for many years. Who knows? Some people might take it up and help the world. So anyway, that's one thing which you throw out there. So anyway, thank you for asking those questions. Eventually you tell other people, you know, there's an ex-chief minister here who maybe sort of, you know, just tells somebody else and tells somebody else, and maybe those messages, you know, get through. Maybe we'd improve our democracies and our governance. And if we do that, we can have a much better Malaysia, a much better world. I don't... You know, I was telling someone, what's my nationality? And recently I was at a conference, a Buddhist conference, and the Malaysian delegation were taking their group photograph. And as I walked out, they invited me over. Ajahn Brahm, you come to Malaysia a lot. Come in our photograph. So I was part of the group photograph for Malaysia. I was very proud of that. And afterwards, I went in the group photograph of the Singapore delegation, and then the Australian delegation. Because why do we separate people from nations? You're my friends, brothers, sisters. So, you know, have you ever gone on an aircraft and looked down? I've never seen this line between Sabah and, you know, Kalimantan. I see it on the maps. It's on Google Earth. But in real life, there's no lines between Brunei and Sabah. Not from the air, anyway. Do you understand what I mean? Okay, so look, let's be friends.
Thank you, Ajahn. Much as we like, the time has come for me to end the question and answer session. Thank you, Ajahn, for another entertaining and inspiring talk about bananas tonight. Ajahn, please, may you lead us in the sharing of merits now. Thank you.
Again, sharing merits with all our deceased relations. Idam enyati nang ho tu sukita hom tu yatayo. Idam enyati nang ho tu sukita hom tu yatayo. Idam enyati nang ho tu. Sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu.